Okay, welcome everybody to February's colloquium, and thanks for coming out on such a cold day. Our speaker today is Dr. Vi Dutcher, a longtime friend of many of us, and is going to be talking to us about work that she did on her sabbatical last year on Amish women's literacy. Vi did her PhD at Kent State University, came here to EMU in, I know that's in here somewhere, 2006. I knew it was a few years before me, and has been teaching here in the language and literature department since then, and also as director of our writing program. Many of you, no doubt, I hope, have interacted with her in the Kairos Place program, which she started a few years ago and that has helped a lot of us, myself included, to get some writing projects done. Vi has published a number of essays both on women's literacy questions, but also on the topic of teaching writing in a variety of journals and anthologies. I know I'm very much looking forward to hearing what she has to say about Amish women. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for coming out today. First, before I start, I want to give a tribute to, I want to dedicate this presentation to John Dutcher, without whom this work would not have been accomplished. He was always ready for a visit to Amish country, loved my sources, and was an integral part of data gathering and analysis during my sabbatical last spring. And today is a first, presenting without his critique and advice beforehand. He always said to me when I was ready to read him something, am I a fan or a critic? He knew to ask that, because if he was a critic and I wanted a fan, that didn't work. So, cheers, John. It's 1999, and we're in Middlefield, Ohio, visiting Amish relatives. My dear Amish cousin Betty had died of pancreatic cancer the past fall, and we made the short trip from Cleveland to Middlefield nearly every week. We loved visiting Betty's husband Menno and his three children, Joey, Barbara, and Rhoda. Rhoda was 10 years old. Often it was she and her dad who went with us to the store, out to eat, to a friend's home. Rhoda and Menno enjoyed being in our car because then we could listen to music on one of our cassette tapes. They also appreciated a nice car. And at that time, we had a 1995 Burgundy Olds 88. On this particular summer evening, we were moving right along, and suddenly Rhoda said with a mischievous grin on her face, I bet this thing would really go. Like her father's horse, fresh off the racetrack and eager to let it go, with buggy flying behind, racing their friend's horse and buggy, she imagined our car racing down the road, showing us its power, with Rhoda flying along. She could feel the power of the engine under her seat, and I knew then that Amish girls liked power. This kind of power, anyway, and that perhaps Amish women did, too. So this afternoon, just sit back and relax, and let's see if this thing can really go. This is a story. It's a story of home, of kitchens, of places where women gather. It's a story of what happens when Old Order Amish women get up in the morning, pack their husbands' lunches, their children's lunches, and send them on their way to the factory in town or the small schoolhouse down on Newcomb Road, and then often arrange for and take an Amish taxi to a friend's home. According to Carolyn Hebron, power resides in discourse. And this may be true in someone else's story, but this is an Amish story, an Amish woman's story. And it's not about power in the way we normally see it. Not in the sense of worldly power, but through the power invested in them by their church, Ordnung, the unwritten rules for the Old Order Amish community. This is a power that was honed long ago by women generations ago within a dominant culture. It's about women who know their place, who have inherited a strong sense of place. And the place informs their work, sustains them, and motivates them. What they do is quite ordinary, perhaps. Through their ordinary work, and I better keep my place here, had I not. through their ordinary work, work that is usually considered private, they exert a kind of control over public space in their communities. So it's a story about women producing habitable space and having an affect on each other in the community through their literacy practices. And by literacy practices, I mean those sets of social behaviors that can be observed in literate events and that result in oral and written texts, adhering to conventions that have social consequences. And those conventions codify social behavior that maintains the rhetoric of an Old Order Amish community, holding to specific gender practices. Their practices, their reading, writing, oral conversations function to sort of shapeshift Old Order Amish women's individual identities into a robust, cohesive community. According to Craybill, Johnson, Wiener, and Nolte in The Amish, the sustaining community is behind the remarkable growth of the Amish. Craybill says it can't all be explained by high birth rate and strong retention. Cohesive community driven by the women's efforts includes everyone who belongs at the table. And I'm going to repeat that because it's the crux of the research. Cohesive community driven by the women's efforts includes everyone who belongs at the table and is primarily responsible for the rapid growth of the Amish church. For the Amish, every meal is Holy Communion, and Holy Communion is every day, three times a day. Single girls, handicapped, I use their labels here, children and adults, the shut-in, accident-prone, factory and farm workers, tour guides, boys and girls belong to this community, and they're served by their women. While all Old Order Amish members, male and female, belong to an active community, the women are engaged in this cohesive work at a fundamental level in their homes and in their relationships with each other. The women write about this work in reflective and descriptive ways using emotive words to create pathos in their readers, deepening the bonds that bind them to one another, reinstating community, shaping it, and being shaped by it into knowledge-making, literate women essential to their communities. Embodied power in the service of the community. The stereotypical notion that Amish women are passive, slaves of work in their homes and chief battle washers, walking three steps behind their men, doesn't really remain standing in this study. Some of this work is hidden in the kitchen in the form of recipes, both written and oral, yet reveled out in the open when good food and good eating takes place around the table. Old Order Amish women create and maintain circle letters, care for the less fortunate community members by way of card making, write and publish poetry in several Amish publications, and represent their communities as scribes by publishing weekly columns in Die Botschaft, or The Messages. Not surprisingly, these women are present at the end of life, bringing food to the living, cleaning the home for the funeral, writing detailed chronological accounts to document the person's illness, copying meaningful poems on colored paper for friends and family, and finally preparing the body for its final viewing and then resting place. Charlotte Hoag writes, "It's easy to be dismissive of women's work, to think of these women as conduits of literacy, passing on a body of knowledge, rather than as interpreters of or even creators of that knowledge. It's a mistaken assumption." Their writing reveals their community's rigorous adherence to communal values, which indeed they do pass on to their children, but they also examine and interpret them, making meaning in their world and reinforcing significant beliefs about who they're becoming in the world. My dissertation dealt with Amish and Mennonite women's recipes and circle letters, and in the 13 years since I defended my dissertation, I've continued this investigation, narrowing my subjects to Old Order Amish women and broadening it to include additional literacy practices. So I'll talk about them here today with the greater focus on letter writing. And it's still an ongoing project. During January through April of 2014, I was on sabbatical as a Kreider Scholar at the Young Center of Anabaptist and Pietist Studies located at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. And I'm deeply grateful for the opportunity to explore the Young Center's extensive archives, abounding with examples of Old Order Amish women's literacies, and to meet Old Order Amish women in the community who are active in their literacy practices. While my research includes several Amish communities in the US, it focuses in large part on the Amish community in Geauga County in Middlefield, Ohio, the fourth largest group of Amish in the United States after Holmes County, Ohio, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and Elkhart LaGrange, Indiana, according to a 2012 record. The Geauga County Amish community includes 94 church districts and 13,255 persons. That's probably changed just in the last hour. Here, the Amish church deacons circulate a newsletter titled Der Gemeindebrief, the community letter, for Old Order Amish church members to use during that week between their church services. This newsletter contains many items of interest that link the various church communities. One of the services provided by the newsletter is a list of all those who are housebound, ailing, grieving, and otherwise indisposed. The deacons exhort members of the Amish community to send cards and letters to these folks, and the women are usually the ones who answer this charge. They write letters of encouragement and cheer, and when those letters arrive at the homes of shut-ins, they are read and then placed in a stack or in a small basket in a place where other family members and visitors may easily pick them up and read them. Their letters, then written in their homes around the kitchen table or sitting at the living room desk, are both public and sacred, no longer private and everyday. And they're a routine part of life. A letter in the mail is the touch of a friend's hand. In this way, news is transmitted, various weather patterns are noted, the health of relatives and friends is documented, and the nuances of daily life are chronicled and shared. Mothers and daughters, sisters, grandmothers and children, grandchildren, cousins, aunts and nieces, and friends, regardless of age, all exchange letters. Informal letters are not only useful as a way to keep in touch with relatives and friends living outside the state, but they're also used regularly to keep in touch with relatives and friends living in the same community. Next door neighbors don't usually exchange letters, but relatives and friends living 5 miles away will do so in this community. 5 miles by horse and buggy is too far apart to be in the same church district, so they may not see each other very often. So with all this letter writing, it shouldn't be any surprise to know that they've found a way, along with other women across the world, to conserve the time and energy spent by having circle letters. Circle refers to the order in which the letter is sent. It begins with one woman who is a member of a pre-selected group of women, and it makes a full circle back to the first writer. Amish girls as young as 10 years old may be members of circle letters as well. However, they're not usually members of the women's circle letters. They're members of circles including girls their own age and are oftener cousins, attending different schools and churches, and not as likely to see each other very often. The women who are members of circle letter groups meet neither in real time, nor do they occupy space in a circle. A member addresses the entire group or the circle when she writes her letter. Although member number 10 may address member number 1 in a letter, members 2 through 9 are looking on, reading, participating, and are positioned in the circle as target audience also. In other words, the letters aren't sent according to who lives at what address so that it travels in a geographical circle, and it doesn't exist in time. Rather, it rhetorically positions and provides location for the audience during a member's reading of the letter, the moment when the circle is activated. In this way, community is evoked every time the circle letter is read. Mrs. Melvin Hirschberger, not her real name, walks briskly down her neatly trimmed driveway to the mailbox. She notices that the rag is still tied to the flag of the mailbox, signaling to the ice cream truck driver to leave 1/2 gallon soft vanilla and 1/2 gallon soft chocolate ice cream. The extended family is gathering at the Hirschberger household that evening, and much work has already been accomplished in the kitchen to prepare food for this crowd of nearly 30. But now, in mid-afternoon, the mail has arrived, and Melvin Sarah is taking time out to get the mail. She quickly selects from the day's mail the thick envelope she has been anticipating for a few days now and makes her way to her favorite spot on the porch, where she can be alone and savor the 12 letters contained in this circle letter envelope. Before reading, she checks to make sure the letters numbered 1 through 12 are in the order in which they were written. Actually, this slide is not of her circle letter, even though it may appear so as I start saying names. She's third on the list, so she begins with number 4, a brief letter on the front and back of a writing tablet page written by her cousin, Malin Martha, who is a few years older than Melvin Sarah and lives in a faraway southern state. She marvels at Malin Martha's news. Her garden is nearly finished already, and she canned 140 quarts of tomato juice on one hot Wednesday. She reads ahead eagerly about news of Mail and Martha's children and who the two oldest girls are dating now. She's saddened to hear about Malin's aunt's illness and makes a mental note to send her a get-well card and letter. As usual, she's comforted by a saying quoted by Mail and Martha, a wise cousin. Melvin Sarah turns to letter number 5 from her Aunt Mary, who lives 10 miles away. Although Ray Mary's news about the weather is hardly a surprise to Sarah, she is curious to know who had church that week in her uncle and aunt's district. As usual, her Aunt Mary takes seriously the scriptural admonition to teach the younger women and has included tips for housekeeping and personal care. Usually they're useful, except the one sent a few years ago to boil potato peelings in water and use that water to rinse her hair to prevent it from turning gray. Not enough potatoes, obviously. Nearly an hour passes while Melvin Sarah reads the 12 letters, saving hers, number 3, until last. She enjoys recalling the day she wrote that letter and marvels how quickly time has passed. She also enjoys imagining her relatives reading that letter, if she's very honest with herself. How did she come across, anyway? Did they think she's a hard worker? Do the women reading her letter think she's friendly enough, yet appropriately reserved? Do they think she's a good woman? She hopes so, yet she knows she doesn't deserve praise for that. She made sure not to write any political views, express any family opinions, report any misbehavings in the family, make crass references to anything, or to have any liberal leanings. Melvin Sarah, as other Old Order Amish women, writes her letter in the privacy of her own home. But, and significantly, her private dwelling is community space. She writes with the gaze of that community over her shoulder, choosing her words and constructing her letter with deliberate care. She knows, for she does it herself, that her letter, when it arrives at its destination, will be read by the addressee and then placed where anyone in the household or a visitor or in the whole wide world may read it without asking permission. Subsequently, she writes very carefully. And as a result, what she may call a letter becomes a recording of weather, work accomplished, persons visited, and an account of who hosted church in their homes. The structure goes something like this: a salutation consisting of a greeting in Jesus' name or some reference to God, a reference to the weather, thanksgiving for life's blessings, which may or may not be named, often followed by an exhortation to live life in a certain way, an update on health issues, and lastly, a chronological cataloging or diary-style listing of daily activities. Her letter is a public record of the family's activities and is an important fact finder for family members. While I found no evidence of written or verbal rules of letter writing, the tradition of letter writing is certainly materialized in these women's letters and reinforces the formulaic structure, which in turn enables the tradition of letter to endure. Social relationships register in the names by which these women are known in their communities. Two of the circle letters I examined represent the traditional naming of females by adding a woman's husband's name in front of her first name. If she's unmarried, she's known informally in the community as her father's daughter, for example, Dan's Ruth. As in the example I shared a moment ago, one participant's name is Sarah Hirschberger. Her husband's name is Melvin. She's known in the community and in the circle letter as Melvin Sarah. Her formal name is Mrs. Melvin Hirschberger. Because letters are written to keep in touch, to strengthen familial ties, and to confirm shared feelings of closeness, empathy, and sympathy, they're written often. And these women take pride in the fact that they don't let a letter sit long before they've answered it and sent it on its way. Women who do not answer quickly are excused if there are extenuating circumstances, for example, an illness in the family or an abundance of garden work. Those are legitimate reasons for neglecting a letter. But ultimately, neglecting a letter is neglecting a friendship. And if neglecting becomes a pattern, in these circle letters at least, that woman soon finds herself receiving few to no letters. In one circle letter, another cousin regularly ends her letter with, "Hurry back," personifying the letters representing their writers. And although most of the cousins who are members of the circle letters are no strangers to the circle letter traditions, an older cousin writes several instructions on the address list. And while only a few of her sentences are in the form of commands, she mentions twice that she may be bossy. Her first instruction, "Please put your underline dates on when you write." She writes further, "I don't want to boss, but I think it would be nice to have Irene in and Chris Betty, two of the cousins' aunts, and even my sis Verna if she'd like. What do you think?" And please, we need to put 22-cent stamps on along with the 33 cents, as it wasn't enough postage, so I put out 25 cents. Another point, if you want to make the letter less for postage, you could use other paper instead of such big sheets. In another circle letter I'm in, they have smaller paper. But it's up to you, and we wouldn't need a big sheet for the names. We could cut part off that's blank, underline. Now, if you think I'm bossy, kick me out, with a smile sign. Please use business letters folded like this so it, the packet, won't be so clumsy and fat. And the last word, fat, is underlined three times. Interestingly enough, she's the one who from time to time kicks herself out when other cousins do not follow her instructions in using the right size envelope, limiting oneself to one sheet of paper and failing to keep the letter moving around rapidly. When the letter arrives at her home, she inserts a short note saying that she's not going to be in the circle anymore because she doesn't receive it often enough. But the cousins are familiar with this behavior, and they ignore it. And by the time it arrives at her home again, she contributes a letter and writes that she missed participating the last time. I swear. These same women meet together often to stamp cards, cards that have become an important part of their letter activity. And as I walked into the trim shed in Middlefield, Ohio, one warm July day, I sense before I can see that it is filled with the bustle of Amish women's artistic activity. Against the far wall, Barbara sets up her card stamping equipment, stacks of colored cardstock paper, over 40 various colored ink stamping pads, approximately 100 wooden stamps and colored pencils. Close by, her elderly mother-in-law knots and trims the threads bordering either end of a rag rug. Later, she will begin to cut apart wood-worn clothing, using the good fabric that remains for quilts. Still another woman continues making her covering or cup, doing the pleats that day. Around the room, three other middle-aged women set up their card-making supplies. Joining today are a few younger women with small children, wanting to get an early start on making Christmas cards. Outside of the shed, yet another woman lays out dark blue broadcloth fabric, overlays it with her homemade pattern, and begins to cut a pair of pants for her husband. Later, she will go home with several pairs cut, not only for her husband, but for her sons also. Another woman removes a tall stack, my eyes got quite wide, of $1 bills from her carry-all and begins folding them in various shapes. She places these renovated bills in cards for those who are confined to their homes because of illness, disability, or accident. Ironically, both designs, a man's shirt with a button-down collar and then a necktie or bow tie, feature articles of men's clothing that Amish men are not permitted to wear. Usually, it's the winter months when these women get together for card stamping. However, some women get together at least once in the summer. Card stamping allows women to gather in their homes together. It allows them to work independently, yet together, make their cards and borrow materials. I believe we've met today so that I may observe their card stamping activity. They believe I've met with them so I can learn how to stamp my own cards, and we finally get this sorted out, which is important if you know me and that sort of thing. Card stamping, using cardstock on which to stamp any number of decorative pictures or inspiring words and making them into greeting cards, is a multi-million dollar business that occupies women around the world. Nonetheless, according to the blogger at splitcoaststampers.com, Amish women comprise a large number of these women. While other women may use the internet to contact card stamping bloggers and card stamping sites to find new ideas, Amish women find out about new stamps and new ideas from their friends and at their local stamping shops. And yet another blogger and Amish romance writer, Cindy Woodsmall, advertises Rachel's Country Store and provides Rachel's blog. Navigating to Rachel's blog, I find this. I'm Old Order Amish, and I own and operate Rachel's Country Store. Friends of mine built this website so that you and your friends can order items online without having to travel to Pennsylvania. And it's www.rachelscountrystore.com. Rachel sells card stamping supplies, among other things, notably Cindy's Amish romance novels, and writes on her blog that Cindy is her favorite romance novel author. So Cindy, Amish romance writer, and Rachel, Amish woman and store owner in Newburgh, Pennsylvania, provide mutually beneficial services. I've met Rachel in her store, and she's a savvy entrepreneur. In this environment in Middlefield, however, in this shed, something else is taking place in addition to creating. Yes, they are artfully designing the cards. However, there's a busy hum in the air. No time is wasted in pondering which design is best. The stamping is done quickly. The cutouts are done speedily. No card is completed on its own from start to finish, which is how I was working. I worked on one card at a time and was often interrupted by the encouragement to make several at a time to save time. The embossing is done first to 25 to 50 cards at once, then a cutout on all of them. The desired words or verse or poem is stamped on all the cards, and the women are limited to the language of the stamps, written by unknown others and mass-produced. This is followed by the gluing on of a ribbon or other decorative pieces, and then the card is pronounced done, all 50 of them. Their talk is centered around how many each woman can get done that day, how many were done earlier, how many remain to be done, how many can they finish before lunch. This is work. It's women's work. It's an Amish woman's work in Middlefield, Ohio. It is a creative process of a different sort than what I know. It's of a sort acceptable to this Amish community that includes efficiency, a high value on efficiency, which is paramount for an old order Amish woman who must make each day count for her labor. She's fulfilling her Amish community duty in remembering the sick and shut-in, holidays, birthdays, and all the reasons why we send cards. The church community expects these connections among members and families to be made. No one is better prepared to do this than the old order Amish woman. She knows who is related to whom. She knows who is ill. She's an integral part of the communal grapevine. And as such, she has a responsibility to the community and is empowered by that community. Another woman recycles Christmas cards, sending 150. Last February, she had already recycled 102 for the next Christmas. She says she cuts out the back of the card and leaves a lip on which to paste a clean sheet. Then she stamps on it and around it and makes it hers. These women state that they like making their own cards because it's fun to work with the equipment, fun to be together, and thrifty to make their own cards rather than purchase them. It gives them their own signature to the cards and personalizes them. Many Amish women, however, write for a far larger audience, and these women are scribes for Amish newspapers. And they enjoy the role of representing their local community in a weekly column. In Die Botschaft, a weekly newspaper published and written by the Amish for the Amish, nearly 600 unpaid scribes, both male and female, are published each week. The newspaper, begun in the early 1970s, has a circulation of over 11,000 in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. In the U.S., the newspaper has enjoyed a 52% growth in the past 10 years. In the past 10 years, the number of women scribes has increased by nearly 67%. You think there might be a connection? Mrs. Gid Beiler, Mrs. William Beiler, Emma Christner, Millie Otto, and Cindy Wengard are Old Order Amish women who live in Orrstown, Pennsylvania, Middlefield, Ohio, Monroe, Indiana, Arthur, Illinois, and Clymer, New York, respectively. They live many miles apart from each other and attend Old Order Amish church services in districts that are quite different from each other, yet share many of the same values and external markings of Old Order Amish. They don't know each other, yet they share a common weekly task. These women are scribes for Die Botschaft. They are a person who writes for the newspaper representing her community. In bold font, centered and above her column, is the name of her town and state in all caps, then her name in italics, and the date of the month, the date with the month, day, and day of the week on the third line. She's found herself in this position by agreeing to someone's request that she do so. Mrs. Gid Beiler, for example, says that 24 years ago, her church deacon's wife asked her to represent their community, and she's been writing the column ever since. I chose five states in which Old Order Amish have settled, and I chose the scribes by whether or not they are women, Old Order Amish, and write regularly. I chose the years 2012 and 2013 because I wanted to examine the writing in its current milieu. After reading several columns published in Die Botschaft, I developed a data collection instrument that included the scribe's name, location, date of published column, the number of paragraphs in the column, and 11 topical categories that emerged from the entire investigation. And I did one of those data collection instruments on each column that I read. I collected these weekly publications. There were 104 for those 2 years, and began examining them using the data collection instrument for each column, and there were a total of 402. Can you see that? So then I coded the content of each of those 402 sheets into these 11 categories and compiled a table of statistics showing the percentage of times the 11 categories showed up in a scribe's column and comparing the five scribes' percentages in these categories for the chosen 2 years. So the categories are listed in the order I found them in the columns: weather, laundry, church, visit, social events, funeral or death, wedding, surgery, illness, birth, and accident. Fairly standard across the different state communities, followed by the number of times I found the subject and the calculated percentage. The scribe names and locations are on the left. So with this quantitative information, I can identify which topics are most important, written about the most times, and qualitatively interpret which values rise to importance for these women who represent their communities. So some questions that I'm asking about this work, larger questions, informed by my field of rhetoric and composition. Who has access to scribe writing? How do Amish women shape or dictate the access? What is the function of Amish women's scribe writing? How does scribe writing make a difference in these Amish women's identity? What does scribe writing do for Amish women? How does scribe writing shape their perceptions of themselves? As a result of scribe writing, how have literacy practices changed? How does scribe writing reflect or represent Amish customs, traditions, values, beliefs? And does scribe writing ever initiate change in the community? I met with Mrs. Gideon Byler at her home on the outskirts of Lancaster County, and she has this to say about her writing. It's like quilting. It's easy. And I thought, well, I don't find that very easy either. She sits at this desk every Monday and writes and sends it in to be published for the following Monday. And again, she says the same thing that the other letters, circle letter folks said to me. She avoids political views, liberal views, crass statements, family wrongdoings, and asserts, we're supposed to look perfect. She always mentions the church service, and she likes to discuss everyday life. She says that people connect to everyday life. And it is this that she does well, connect. In a July column, she writes, Dad Byler's moved into the basement at Raymond Lance's while they wait on their modular home to arrive. They will stay at Roman's with Dad's Parkinson's disease, as it's best for Mom to be with her daughter, Sarah. I would be just like that. No one can take a daughter's place. Roman and Sarah deserve a pat on the back for their genuine love and caring. Pray for each other as we journey on. Gil? I will say here that each week when DeBoetschaft arrived at the Young Center, we all tried to grab it first to read her column. Mrs. Gideon Byler, or Linda, writes this column, and also one for The Connection, another publication. She's most popular, however, outside of her Old Order Amish community for her Amish romance novels, where she is known by her less formal name, Linda Byler. Some folks in her church have chided her for writing in this genre and have complained to their bishop, who, upon reading one of her books, said, what's wrong with a little romance? And the bishop is her brother. As scribes, what are these women writing about in the columns and under what conditions? Clearly, my category of social events is discussed the most in these scribes' columns. These events are a tribute to a robust social community revolving around church membership and caring for one another. A social event doesn't necessarily mean that these women are gathering to have a leisurely time together. Usually, in fact, they're organized around work. For example, a group of women may meet at another church member's home who is having church the following Sunday. Laura Lapp, the daughter of Linda Byler, writes in her book, An Amish Garden, A Year in the Life of an Amish Garden. Having church means lots of work, including cleaning everything thoroughly inside and out. We have church services in our basement because that's the room with the most space. The whole house must be clean, upstairs and down. While together, the women wash windows inside and out, scrub walls, moving heavy furniture to clean every corner of a wall or floor, and they enjoy lunch and conversation, or as they say, fellowship together. Women may gather for Sisters Day, or in some communities, Buddies Day, where the women meet in one of their homes and bring along sewing to work on as they talk and share lunch. They may also have a quilting and gather around a quilt that one of them has pieced. They may also meet in order to visit local Amish schools. These schools welcome visitors, and it's not unusual to see adults other than the teacher sitting in the back observing the children and the teacher. Often, if the women have decided to spend their day visiting several local schools, they take lunch for the children and the teacher. In one community, the women get together to play bingo. In another community, the scribe names her group as the church ladies. When the church ladies come to visit, it's a special day indeed for a shut-in, too ill to travel, an elderly person who finds it difficult to navigate her community but can still write, or a mother caring for one or more handicapped or special children. Other gatherings may include the men to raise a barn, chop wood, cut hay, or if it's January, butcher for pork or beef. It's difficult to say which is mentioned more often in these scribes' columns after social events, the church or the weather. Weather is key to these women's activities. In many months, rain will prohibit her from doing her laundry. And of course, she's writing this on Monday morning usually, so that's Monday's laundry day, in case you didn't know. In the winter, the laundry may be hung outside and freeze on the line, or it may be hanging on wooden frames inside the house or on lines on the porch. These women, for the most part, have gardens that are dependent upon the weather. Readers may follow the seasons in these columns as the women freeze strawberries, can peaches, applesauce, and freeze corn. They pick raspberries and blueberries and will hire a van and driver together to pick cherries in season. The productivity of these seasons is dependent upon the weather, and they write about that weather with regularity. It is, with few exceptions, mentioned first in the column. And then it's followed by commenting on the progress of the Monday morning's laundry. And when Monday morning comes, she sits at her kitchen table and begins to write while church or gmeh is fresh on her mind. Lastly, according to Craybill, Johnson, Weiner, and Nolte in their book The Amish, the number of poets writing for Amish publications has increased dramatically in recent years. In the magazine Family Life, for example, the yearly number of poems has increased from 19 to 90 between 1989 and 2009. The editors of Family Life assert that the quality of the poems has kept pace right along with the increase in quantity. Family Life is a magazine published 11 times a year by Pathway Publishers in Aylmer, Ontario, Canada. The magazine contains letters to the editor, essays, short stories, poems, children's contributions and sections, quizzes, recipes, and artwork. Only 20% of the poetry published in the 11 issues in 2012 are written by Old Order Amish women, as identified by the Family Life editor David Luthy. And I'm still waiting to calculate for 2013 because they're in the binder's shop and I couldn't get that information. Plain Interest is a newspaper published each month by David Wagler, editor also located in Aylmer, Ontario. It includes an editorial, letters to the editor, questions and answers concerning personal health, advertisements, writings from Amish and Old Order Mennonites in many communities across the U.S. and Canada. These writings include stories, essays, admonitions, reports of accidents, cautions concerning various types of farming, how-tos, and recipes. The Diary of the Old Order Churches is a magazine published each month of the year by an editor in Bart, Pennsylvania. The front cover states in all caps that this publication is a contribution of the church, for the church, by the church, in the interest of collecting and preserving its historical virtues. The front page features a poem, the only poem in the publication each month. The inside of the publication includes an editorial, a synopsis of the current publication, letters to the editor, names and addresses of persons needing mail because of illness or accidents, several pages of births, baptisms, marriages, obituaries, districts divided, ordinations, migrations, accidents. Community notes take up most of the remainder of the publication and a monthly diaries section that includes various diaries from a lot of writers. With the exception of Family Life, most of the Old Order Amish poets are women. And while many of the poems are nameless, stating a reader from Kentucky, for example, or giving only initials, others will include a name that identifies the writer as a woman. This seems to me to be, I have a question about this, a powerful individual act on the part of an Old Order Amish woman who's steeped in community. If this is the case, and since gender roles are among the Old Order women tend to be prescriptive, I wondered whether or not Old Order Amish consider poetry to be women's writing. And if so, what kind of work that does for their communities. And the same questions that I ask about scribe writing pertain here as well. So also I set out to examine this poetry to uncover what makes a good poem for these women. For the editors and readers of the publications, they might, quite likely, have a different standard than what mainstream American readers consider good poetry. In other words, what may be considered a really good poem in these pages may not be considered a good poem by the editor of The New Yorker, and vice versa. My poetry project is not a comparison, however, of these two particular sets of guiding principles. Rather, I want to know what the Old Order Amish women think are good. I want to know what the Amish community values in the poetry. I want to know how these poems represent these Amish women's meaning making of their world. They're moved to deep feeling by the life experiences they encounter. They're no strangers to hard work, to living closely to the soil, to experiencing the joys of many community weddings and the tragedies of so many deaths in their communities, both young and old people. Farm accidents involving children, young adults, and men and women in the prime of life are not rare in this community. So in these three publications, I found a total of 58 poems during the 2 years, 2012-2013, written only by Old Order Amish women. I identified who wrote the poems by communicating with the publication's editors, because most of the time I didn't know what the gender was of the writer. I compiled several Excel files for each publication, categorizing and compiling information concerning the poems, and I came up with the categories of reflective and descriptive to identify particular sets of writing. So in this slide, we see the comparison of the amount of reflective poems in each publication. In this next slide, can you see? Oh, that's really tiny. I'm sorry. Let me see if I can. Is that better? We see the comparison of reflective and descriptive poems. Obviously, more poems are descriptive than reflective. And I personally, you know, have a high value on reflective writing, but that's not how these are. Within the poems, I identified many emotive words that are strong in pathos, calling for emotional responses in the readers, evoking community. The number of lines in the poetry vary greatly, with the longest poem having 138 lines and the shortest having 8 lines. The average length was about 28 lines. Themes of these poems include holidays, religion, nature, home, mother, gratitude, and the mail carrier, hailing the work of the person taking out and bringing in the mail. I was surprised by how many wrote about the mail carrier. Although Pennsylvania German is usually the first language of these women, English is the language of the poetry. The poets do not slip one word into these poems, one Pennsylvania German word into the poems, unlike the scribes and letter writers. And although these poems are written by Old Order Amish women working in their homes according to very strict gender roles, the poems themselves do not usually represent their housework. Only 10 or 18% of the poems overall mention laundry, mopping floors, cooking, mending, and gardening. These poems have readers like Rhoda Miller, whom you met at the beginning of my talk. Rhoda is now 25 years old, a married Old Order Amish woman with 3 children. She uses recipes for her cooking, is a member of several circle letters, participates in card stamping, and reads what other women write in their Amish newspaper columns and poetry. She's an empowered, literate, Old Order Amish woman, and she still enjoys getting in my car and seeing if this thing will go. Thank you. Thank you. And I will add here that when we go to Common Grounds, right, for the reception, I have a table there with an Amish tablecloth on it and some artifacts for you to look at. And one of them, I just couldn't believe the serendipity of this, but I have a Amish bonnet, young girl's bonnet in my office, and I checked it, and it's Rhoda Miller's bonnet when she was a young girl.
We have some time for questions for Vi.
Thanks, Vi. That was a wonderful journey. So I'm intrigued with your research methods because you obviously did participant observation, you did ethnographic research, as well as a lot of content analysis. And I was particularly taken with your coding categories for the scribes. Did you develop them inductively or deductively? How did you go about developing those categories?
Inductively, Dave. I read those columns more than once. And I had John reading too. And we would talk about that. What's coming up here to the surface? And so those categories for the scribes came from what we were seeing. Yeah. And so I don't think that there's anything talked about in those 2 years of scribe writing that isn't in a category up there. Yeah.
Thank you, Vi. I assume Pennsylvania Dutch is still a vibrant medium for conversation, mm-hmm. but the circle letters seem to all be written in English. Are some in Pennsylvania Dutch? Or
I didn't find any. Pennsylvania Dutch or German is not traditionally a written language. I mean, there is a New Testament out now. There may even be an Old Testament now. But Amish children are not taught to write in Pennsylvania German. They're taught German. And then they learn English in school. A Pennsylvania Dutch word might sneak in, but they write in the language of school, which is another very interesting part of that, yeah.
So I'm intrigued by the kind of self-policing of content, right? And then there was a column that I read while you were talking about a young woman who died. But what I couldn't figure out is, was that a suicide? Because the way the column was written, it talked about a head trauma from untreated Lyme disease and...
Oh, okay. I'd like to go back to that, but I'm not able to make my slides move. Lyme disease is a killer in Orrstown, Pennsylvania, in that area.
So it said untreated Lyme disease and mental...
Yes, and there's a doctor in the area who they do not trust. Mm-hmm. They think he's very quick to diagnose Lyme's disease, which he probably is for a reason.
Yeah.
And so they don't trust it. And so this, Linda told me that this woman, this young girl, they didn't take her for treatment right away. And so it was undiagnosed for quite a while.
Okay, yeah. but it said untreated Lyme disease and a head injury. And then there was a whole thing about judging at the bottom. It was a fascinating column.
Yeah, it is.
Because it was, I don't know if anybody else had time to read it, but it was layers and layers of what to an outsider I would say was hidden coded messages.
Right. Yeah, she had an accident, and I'm not able to recall exactly what it was. But there was a lot of, even though the entire community was not trusting this doctor and were you know, not sure that they should go right away, there was judgment on the family for not taking her quickly.
Okay.
So there was a lot of guilt.
Okay.
Guilt was running rampant. And she used her powers of scribe-iness to say to people, come
don't
on.
Don't blame.
It's enough.
Yeah.
It's enough now. Let's get it stopped.
Yeah,
and she did that often. She would do that. Yeah.
But it also seems to me that this self-policing and this leaving the letters out means there's actually no space for women to talk about anything like sexual abuse or violence or anything that might be happening in the women's community.
Not in that public.
Not
sphere.
So so that's like a shutdown space, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
It might, you know, come out in conversation, but yeah. Because shame, I mean, shame is a whole issue I haven't even addressed here, but shame is a tremendous shaper and conforming.
In the public writing space, then there's not this place for women to actually talk about these things.
So in these circle letters, I found out that some of these women were experiencing rather horrific things with their children, but they never showed up in a circle letter. Never. And yet everybody who was reading the letters knew. But it didn't come up. Yeah.
Nate Yoder, if I may reference my question with Stuart to make sure that I've got this accurate, and then ask if we have an explanation of the significance of it. When a husband's name is used to identify the wife, among the Old Order Mennonites in this community. That is done, but the wife's name comes first. When I was pastor at Dayton Mennonite, somebody from Old Order background, it would have been Nellie Byard and Nellie Sam, both of them women who are identified by their husband's names, but the order is the other way around.
They weren't talking about the man.
No. No,
they're talking about. Interesting.
Do you have any comment? Am I accurate with that? So my reference to you then, Vi, is were you aware of that, or what do we code into that?
I'm aware of in some instances of the men's name coming first, but not for the reason that you give locally here. It was a way of, for example, in my hometown, there was Atlee Sue, and there was also Suette. And people have speculated, and this isn't, you know, highly researched, this is anecdotal, but people speculate that it's the men who are known by their wives' names first are the men who had very dominant wives. I'll just say it that way. But I did not know about that practice in locally here, about referring to, still referring to women with their name first. It's very interesting, yeah.
I love this, Vi. A question about your thesis of the health of the community connected to the health of the literacy dominated by the women. Mm-hmm. Is there any way to test that thesis? In other words, you said that when a particular paper came into the Young Center, you all competed to find the one most popular scribe, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Is her community stronger, better, more driven by Amish values than other communities? And could any of it be attributed to her skill as a writer?
Wow. How would we test that? That's a fascinating question. Especially given the fact that their communities, I mean, they're all related. You know, in Linda's community, are all her married daughters, and she has several, and her brother is the bishop. I mean, she's not related to everybody, but a good many, because once a district gets so large, and it varies from place to place, they're split off. They make a new district. And so the districts are kept intentionally small, and they all know each other. But that's interesting. I have plenty more work to do on this. And one is I want to visit Almere, of course, and meet with these editors of these magazines. And I also want to visit each community, each scribe's community. I visited Linda. And I know the Middlefield community, but I've not been in Clymer, New York, or Monroe, Indiana, or LaGrange, Indiana. And I'd like to get to all of those and talk to those women. And that would be a good time probably to see if we could create an instrument to. You could be my research buddy.
Just a follow-up question to tag on to Jane's, because I think she's really on to something very interesting. If, in fact, the health of the community is related to the health of the writing, could it be that some coded messages that are in fact allowing greater space exist mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. inside certain ones mm-hmm. of these messages?
I didn't have this in here because I don't know if I'm onto something or not. But when I looked at all those letters and when I knew what those women were going through, their quotations, their sayings, the scripture they reference said it all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Vi. I miss reading Family Life since my in-laws are not living anymore. My question is, what draws you, what draws your heart toward doing this? Why have you spent so much time doing this?
That's a good question. My mother and father were raised Amish, and my father While he left the Amish without becoming a member and moved 50 miles south, he had a high regard for his background and his people, even though he didn't want to live that way and was mystified sometimes by behavior he saw. But when I was a child, we went to Geauga County from Stark County, an hour's drive every other week. We would go to church for Sunday school and leave and go up to Geauga County, as we called it, to visit our relatives. That was a must until my grandpa died, and then we didn't go quite as often, but still very often. So I grew up knowing my cousins, playing with them. And when John and I were married, he went with my family a few times to visit, and he remarked immediately that, "I don't like the way your parents visit these people. We see everybody in one day, and we don't get to know anybody." And so we started on our own striking out and getting to know my cousins. So we'd go up and just visit one or two, and we'd go up fairly often. And so I got to know them deeply. And then when I began college, which probably most of you know how that happened, but I had always wanted to go to school, and my dad forbade me to go to college. And in 1989, when I was 38 and our last child was going to school, John asked me what I planned to do that fall. And I said, "Well, I'm going to ask my boss at the Mennonite restaurant if I can work days now instead of evenings and Saturdays, so I'm home with the children." And he said, "No, you're not going to do that. You're going to go back to school." And I said, "I'm 38, and I gave up that dream a few years ago." He said, "That's nonsense." So I went back to school. And in my senior year, I took a literary theory class, and we had to write short little two-page papers on various theories, and I used my grandmother's recipes to deconstruct a particular theory, deconstruct them by means of a particular theory. And my professor, who was the grad student advisor, wrote in the margin, "This is the beginning of your doctoral dissertation." And so it matters what we write on student papers. It really does. I had been accepted to a grad program for my master's degree, but I wasn't even considering a doctoral program at that time. And that put the seed in. And then when I got to my, in my master's program, already in the first semester, they were pushing us, the professors were pushing us to decide whether or not we were going to write a thesis or not. And if we were going to make that our terminal degree, they wanted us to do a thesis. If we were going to go on for a doctorate, they wanted us to just take courses. They said, you have nothing to profess, you know. So I didn't know what I was going to do. And then just as I was starting the second semester, John was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And that really helped me. That and some other things helped me decide to continue. But when I realized what I loved, I was fascinated with these people who were my people. And yet I was a generation removed, so I wasn't shunned. I could ask questions that I'm sure my father could not ask.
Thank you, Vi, for a really interesting presentation. And as she noted, we'll have opportunity to go to Common Grounds for a light reception and chance to look at some artifacts. So thank you for doing that. Please come back next month. Our speaker will be Janine Wadle from George Mason University. And I called up her title on my phone. Let me see if I can get it here quickly. She's at George Mason School of Policy and Government and International Affairs. She's written some award-winning books on the areas of power elite, and she's going to be talking about her most recent book, Unaccountable, How Elite Power Brokers Corrupt Our Finances, Freedom, and Security. So it should be a really provocative and interesting talk. So see you next month. Thank you.